In other words, when people were fascinated with Buddha and what he had to say, they got to a point where some people were starting to venerate him to the point where they wanted to worship him. And Buddha's answer to that was, absolutely not. Don't look to me, he says, look to my Dharma or my doctrine. That's going to show you what to worship or who to worship. On the other hand, with Jesus, when people came to him wanting to worship him, he unequivocally accepted their worship. Not only did he say, I'm a God, but he said, I am the God. In chapter 9 of John, we see one of the most pointed examples of this, although it's all through the Gospels. You might remember this story. There was a guy that was blind from his birth, it says. And Jesus healed him. He got his sight back. And the religious leaders were a little miffed by the whole thing, worried that this was going to start a movement and more people were going to just start following Jesus and his radical claims. And so they talked to this guy. They wanted to see, did you really get healed? I mean, what's going on here? And the guy's just a simple guy. You probably remember that. He goes, listen, all I can tell you is I was blind. And now I see. And they got frustrated with him because they wanted him to even kind of lie about the whole thing and not admit what had really happened, and they kicked him out. And Jesus went and found him later, and John records that Jesus said this to him. Jesus heard that they had thrown him out, and when he found him, this man who had been healed, that Jesus had healed, Jesus said, do you believe in the Son of God? He answered and said, who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him? Jesus said, you have now seen him. In fact, he is the one speaking with you. Then the man said, Lord, I believe. And he worshiped him. And right after that, Jesus actually validates him worshiping him and says, not only has this guy, basically he implies what he says there, is not only has this guy's physical eyesight been cleared up, but his spiritual eyesight has been cleared up. He validates this guy bowing down and worshiping him. He unequivocally takes it and accepts it. It's all throughout the Gospels. This kind of thing happens. Unlike so many other religious leaders, he accepts it. And one of the things that's really unexplainable about Jesus is this. A lot of guys, I guess, you know, these big historians that do an analysis of all the great historical figures that were some of the most prominent and influential figures throughout human history, would maybe narrow it down to 20 people who were some of the most influential figures throughout history. And of course, Jesus is included in that. Then they might bring it down to 10, and he's in there. And for some, they may narrow it down to 3, and he's involved with that. For some, there might even be a general consensus that Jesus Christ was the single most influential individual in the history of the world. But the point being is that he's in that fraternity. He's in that group, that elite group of people that were some of the most influential and prominent figures throughout history. But the point being is they're all respected and they're all looked at as great people, and that's why they had influence, but yet only Jesus was the one who claimed to be God. The other ones were opposite, and actually that's why they were respected. Because they had a humility about them, and when somebody tried to claim that they were God, they're like, no, no, don't go there. Jesus went there, and he's still revered and respected. How can that be? It doesn't make any sense. I mean, there's been dozens of other people that have claimed to be God, but they didn't get that kind of following. You know, they got a few imbalanced, marginalized, ragtag people that followed him. My theological term for them are wackos. Actually, Kevin, I don't know, I picked that up once from you. I think this is a theological term that he, as one of our elders, got from the Bronx. He calls them quacks. You know, I mean, they get a small group of people that follows them around, some small, unbalanced group. But on the other hand, you've got dozens of people who have been some of the most influential people. And in almost all their cases, again, they projected that humility, and that was what really why people respected them, is that when people tried to venerate them as some type of deity, they said, no, don't do that. All the people in the most, considered the most influential people that have really affected the masses, some of the greatest minds throughout history have followed these people and been influenced by these people. None of them went as far as to say they were God. Except one guy. One guy in that group who still revered and respected claimed that he was God. He fulfilled both categories, which is bizarre. He was looked at and respected as a very humble individual, yet he still claimed to be God Almighty. Incredible claims for himself. And what's really wild is he got so many throngs of people convinced to believe it. Here's the crazy part. C.S. Lewis talks about this a little bit in his Mere Christianity. Tim Keller talks about it as well. And it's something that maybe you never thought about, but the group that became convinced that he was actually God in human form was the least likely group to ever be convinced. Because 99.9% of all the people that were convinced in the beginning of his work were first century Jews. I mean, if he'd started this movement in the East, it would have made more sense, you know. In the East, they all kind of believed, like, sort of like they still do today, that God's more like a light force and he's manifest through anything or anyone, you know? And so it wouldn't have been that weird or bizarre for somebody to claim that they were an actual human manifestation of God, you know? They all kind of believe that. And actually, in the Western Greek and Roman world, it wouldn't have been that bizarre either, because they got all these pagan religions where they believe in all these different gods, and often the gods would appear as some kind of human being, a god disguised as a human being. So that wouldn't have been weird either. But the first century Jews, as we talked about last week, had this view of God, this high view of God, this transcendent God that was unmatched by any other spiritual group of people. They believed he was totally other. He wasn't in the trees. He wasn't in the animals. He was involved. He's imminent. He's in our lives. He cares. He hears. He leads. He talks to us. But he's still out there. He's transcendent. He's above all. He created all. He's beginningless. And they had all of these commands that they were taught, that a lot of us were taught. But in the first century Israel, man, I mean, it was very religious. I went to Israel a couple months ago. Arlene White is actually there right now. Looking forward to talking to her when she gets back. But, you know, it's very secular there now. You've got your religious groups. But in first century, man, every single boy and girl went to Hebrew school. They learned their stuff. They would memorize large sections of the Torah and so forth. And they were taught the commands. And you know, the first two commands that top the list is that you never, ever worship any other created thing. You only worship the Creator. You don't worship other created. So the first century, especially, Jews did not go around worshiping a cat or a dog or the sun or the moon. And they certainly didn't go around worshiping a human being that claimed to be God. They didn't even write the name of God. It was too holy. Yet, this least likely group had throngs of them that were beginning to believe that this man was actually God in human form. The least likely group. Least likely group. In the book of Acts, chapter 2, it says 3,000, and it was in Jerusalem, people who had been raised, you shall have no other gods before me. Don't make any graven images, were convinced that God had been manifested in this man. They were ready to worship the Son of Man, Jesus Christ. They believed it was a whole new revelatory idea that the Messiah was not only an anointed one, but it was God in human form. Another 5,000 men were converted in the fourth chapter of Acts. Now, if they were married, we're up to 10,000. Within four chapters of Acts, up to approximately maybe 20,000 Jewish people who were taught to never worship a person or a thing, and they're worshiping this man. What happened? How were they convinced? And then you go to the really religious throngs. I mean, as a general rule, Israel was very religious, but then you had these other sects that were like on religious steroids, man. I mean, they were like, you had the Essenes in the desert, you know, doing their thing. You had the Sadducees. You had Pharisees. I mean, they grew up in these communities, and these kids were like, forget it. I mean, it was ground into their minds. We know how Saul of Tarsus was. He was angry when he found out that this movement was taking place and people were actually worshiping a human being. What are you kidding? That violates the first two commandments. And he's persecuting the movement, and yet he ends up becoming convinced, and he writes something like this to the early believers in Colossae. He, talking about Jesus, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. And don't let that firstborn throw you. That's just a Jewish term. It's about positional, not chronological. Not saying he was, you know, because if he was literally the firstborn, that means he could have created everything. And then the verse ends up criticizing itself because he goes on right after that. So he obviously means, and some Bibles even translate it, that not just firstborn, but he's supreme. He's above all because for everything was created, by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. He's talking about this man. He's saying, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things were created by him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He's obviously giving the attributes that only belong to God, and he's attributing them to Christ himself, to Jesus. Of course, is the Greek term for Messiah. It wasn't his last name. It's the Greek word for Messiah, his title. This power had gotten a hold of him. John confirmed the same thing. One of his disciples grew up in the very religious community of Galilee, hung out with him for 3 years, and was convinced of the same thing. The first line of his gospel, he says this: in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Because for the Jewish people, words were the way in which God expressed himself for centuries. There's scriptures, time and again, read them. You've seen it. It says, and the word of the Lord came. And the word of the Lord said, and the Lord would then express himself through language. And now John's saying, you know what? Now we've seen that he's not just even expressing himself through words. We've seen God express himself through the personality of Jesus Christ. He came down and he took on human form. The word of the Lord became flesh. And of course, Jesus confirmed this himself. He accepted worship, and he would say things like this: he that has seen me has seen the Father. I mean, that's a pretty radical thing to say. He's saying, if you've seen me, you've seen God. You want to know what God's like? See what Jesus is like. That's what he's saying. See what I'm like. And of course, he made that statement just after he said, you know, I'm the truth, the life, and the way, and nobody comes to the Father except by me. In other words, nobody arrives at what ultimate reality is except through me. They're not going to get it. You know what it is? You just can't write them off as a good person. It's not a choice. You have to deal with the radicalness of the claim, the magnitude of the claim. That's what C.S. Lewis made so big over half a century ago in his Mere Christianity book. I think he's the one who came up originally with that Lord, liar, or lunatic. You know, either Jesus is actually who he said he was, he's Lord, or he's a loony bin, man. I mean, come on. You know, you go around and say that you're God. You've seen me. You've seen God. Good people don't really go around saying that. Well, he's just an outright liar or deceiver. You know, in Jesus' day, not everybody accepted his claims, which is interesting because they actually met Jesus. They saw Jesus and they heard the radical of his claims. See, what happens sometimes is we can allow the radicalness of his claims to get lost in the scriptures. But man, when you were living there and you heard him talk and you heard him say things, well, before Abraham was, get what? I am. What? Oh, you wanted to see God? Well, you can. Here I am. How do you like him? I mean, come on. We brush over this stuff. This is wild. This was radical stuff that he was saying, and not everybody accepted it. There were throngs of Jewish people who did, but there were, as we know, a lot who didn't. That's why he ended up crucified. Here, look at this. This is how one group reacted. We're not stoning you, they're talking to Jesus, for any of this other stuff, replied these Jews, but for blasphemy, because why? You, a mere man, claim to be God. They got it. They knew what he was talking about. They knew a good guy wasn't really a choice. See, if you really meet Jesus, if you really study his claims, actually, the reaction will be either you'll be disgusted or you'll bow down and worship him. The in-between thing, you know, he's a good guy, but, you know, all that God stuff he said. Good people don't go around telling people that they're God. They're weird. Unless they really are who they say they are. I mean, I've used that line. I think it was Josh McDowell who used it. You know, Jesus' claim to be God is either one of the most cruel, vicious, deceptive hoaxes ever propagated on the face of the planet, or it's one of the most fantastic facts and events. It's either the most horrible, ferocious farce, or it's the most fantastic fact. It's one or the other. It's like, man, the most deceptive thing ever propagated on humanity, or it's the most amazing event to ever take place in humanity. Jesus says, listen, you know, it's either yay or nay. You're either for me or against me. I'm telling you, I'm God. All right? You can't really just blow it off and say, well, he's a nice guy. It's okay. But here's the thing. The people closest to him were the ones who were most passionate for him. See, sometimes if you don't really know the person that well, get a little bit exaggerated claims about what he actually was like and so forth. You know, I mean, I'll tell you in my own experience, you know, if anybody, it's never really happened, but if it did, you know, and somebody was like, oh, you know, Pastor Greg, he's such a godly man, you know. Well, you know what? Just talk to the people who live with me, okay? They'll set you straight real quick, you know. You got to see the old man when he's getting up off the wrong side of the bed in the morning. You know, whatever it is. But these guys, the funny thing is with Jesus, these guys lived with him. They ate with him. They walked with him. They slept with him. And it was like the more time they spent with him, the more radical their claims became about him. They didn't get more like, oh, yeah, well, you should have seen. We saw Jesus over here. John, one of his closest disciples, hung out with him. He's got nothing bad to say. I mean, that even happens with people, right? We start to venerate them as something maybe a little higher than they should be. And then all of a sudden, man, some interview comes out, right? Some book comes out and tells you the real deal and all the selfishness and the cruelty that was going on with that person just begins to come forward. And you know, you find out that never happened with Jesus. These were their closest people, these disciples. And yet, you know, it did. My favorite book title always tell you, everybody's normal until you get to know them. But with Jesus, man, he became like more normal the more they got to know him. They finally actually got to see what a normal person is supposed to look like without all of this like selfish nonsense that's always screaming in the back of our head. Well, that's not right. That wasn't fair. Why didn't? What did he really mean by that? He didn't have all that buzz going on in his head. You know, listen, even apart from all the miracles, could you imagine living with somebody who's like perfectly loving? That alone must have been mind-blowing, to just hang out with him. And everything he did was just perfect. And they, along with many other people who saw him speak and just do these unexplainable events, apparent miracles. I mean, there was a group of 5,000 people, and all they had was some bread and fish, and they fed the whole group. Others who were closest with him said he walked on water, he raised the dead, he healed sick people. And it just created this incredible sensation of people following him. And then, what's even more wild is after he's killed, instead of that killing the movement, it catapulted it into an even higher acceptance and momentum. Paul said that there were many that saw him risen. At one time, there was even 500 that actually saw him. And that's believed, he says, when he writes that, 1 Corinthians 15, he says, there's even many eyewitnesses that are still around to see it. See, when you've still got eyewitnesses, you can't start creating a legendary, exaggerated claims when eyewitnesses are still around. You know, I could start trying to maybe make some exaggerated claims about what things were really like when I came here 17 years ago. But there's still a lot of people that even attend here today that were here 17 years ago. And if I start like exaggerating things, they're like, whoa, wait a minute. I was there. That didn't happen. Paul's saying, listen, there's still plenty of people around that were witnesses of that. Go ask them. Check it out for yourself. We may not have the advantage of actually seeing Jesus risen from the dead. We can certainly, and many of us have, experienced him risen from the dead in our own lives. But just look at the record, man. You know, what do they call it now? Shane and some of those guys, they like to call themselves red-letter Christians, man. They like to just get into the red letters, what Jesus had to say. You can't make stuff up, man. I mean, look at how he answers everybody. You know, oh, should we pay Caesar or should we pay God? You know, should we really pay our taxes? Well, whose picture's on the coin? Caesar. Okay, so pay to Caesar what you owe him and pay to God what you owe. You can't make that up. You get a lady caught in adultery. They say to him, Rabbi, listen, you know the law. You grew up with like the rest of us. You went to Bethsaida and all the other schooling like we did. And you seem to really be an expert in it. And you know the law says she's got to be stoned to death. What do you say? Well, how about the first one that's without sin? You can't come up with better lines than that. I mean, come on. If somebody made this stuff up, you know what? Let's study and find out who made it up, because they got to be one of the most brilliant, innovative persons. Come on. This is wild stuff. It's so obvious once you get to look at it. That's one person, I don't even know who wrote it, but it was quoted, and they just said, someone said. So I don't know who came up with it first. They just said, no one has ever said the things that Jesus ought to have said. You know, you don't read one of his lines and you're like, you know, he really should have replied that way. You read it and it's like, wow. Just look at the way he responds. Look at the way he responds. Basically, it just comes down to this. Buddha and other religious leaders said, let me show you the way. Jesus says, I am the way. Other religious leaders, they come forward and they say, listen, don't worship me, I'm not God. Jesus comes forward, he says, I am God. Don't just look to my teachings, look to me. And then the most mind-blowing thing is he says, listen, don't just look to me and feel like now you're going to have to slavishly try and be good enough to ascend to come up to me, but instead I am going humbly and mercifully come down and meet you. And I'm going to live the life that you should have lived, and actually I'm going to die the death that you should have died for your sins. Paying the penalty that you owed. I mean, basically, Jesus looks at me and he says, Greg, come on, just get real. You're never going to be able to be good enough. You're never going to be able to be moral enough to make it on your own. So I came all the way down and took your place. And he looks at us and he says, believe in me. Believe in me. It's my body in place of yours, broken for you. Remember me. Remember me. And in the same manner, he says, it's going to be my blood shed in place of yours. I love this concept we read recently in our small group. You ever think about why Jesus had to come twice? You know, why couldn't he just come the first time and just wipe out the whole mess, you know? And get rid of all the evil and just start clean? Because then none of us would be here. If he's going to wipe out the evil, then he'd have to wipe out us. But what he did is he came the first time so that justice could be served through mercy. And he died and paid the price. So when he comes back, he can get rid of the evil without having to get rid of us. His blood shed for you in place of what you owed. Do this and remember me. You know what I wanted to do this morning? I haven't done this for a while.